Nice to see all of you here today. I'm glad I'm here. Thank you. All of you folks who listen in Dallas, Fort Worth, I have a special message for you. I got a ring in my... Listen, take your earphones off and listen. I got an echo. And it gets on my nerves. You folks in Dallas, Fort Worth, not many there, maybe a few, but a lot of people in front of me and who listen here in Los Angeles will remember the purposes of Secret One. And I was just sharing with Dr. Vadillo, who tortured me before the service. Actually, he's pretty good with a needle. But he's a bloodsucker. Anyway, I was telling Dr. Vadillo, who was back in the office, shooting a needle in me and taking blood for a test, that Secret One, more than I am able to tell any of you, completely fulfilled its purpose to you that were part of Secret One during the recent crisis involving the settlement of our church property dispute. And that's all I can or will say. But among other things, to those that remember Secret One, I haven't spoken too much about the fact that we have made a mark, not only in the snotty horse world, but in the elite of the elite, philatelic world. I have very recently been appointed to the American Philatelic Foundation Board of Directors, and just this week in Dallas, with one of those collections that goes back to my boyhood and that I kept very, very secret, and nobody even dreamed where the material was, I finally burst it on the scene in Dallas, Texas, full-orbed this week. And we won, there were four international judges at the Dallas Philatelic Show, and against some amazingly stiff competition, we won the show's grand award for the Columbian States. I may bring it home and do what I've promised. In fact, I've decided I am going to do it right now. I'm going to put that one collection on display in the foyer next Sunday with the gold medal it has just won plus. You win a gold medal based on a criteria that's supposed to be applied no matter what the country or area. It must rise to a certain level to earn a gold medal, which is not easy. Some people exhibit for a lifetime and never win a gold medal. Then among all the entries there is at every show a grand award given for the best of the show in which all exhibits horizontally compete against the best of the show. There are 30 national shows or thereabouts that qualify for the Champion of Champions, which is the World Series of Philately in this country. And I think I've told you in the past, and this is only important to those that were part of Secret One, who know all the purposes behind it. I am the only man in the history of philately that won Champion of Champions twice with two separate exhibits. both of which are on display at Secret One, and I should probably put them on display here also. But at least Columbian States will be next Sunday. If I have time, I'll put them all three on display and give you a chance to look at these philatelic treasures. It brings you into contact with the elite of the world. Everybody is well aware of the owner of the Kings and his multiple interests. Not too many are aware of his stamp collecting history. The same could be said of Ted Turner. Everybody's aware of Amundsen Bank, but not too many people know of his, before he died, his philatelic interests. The Crocker Bank people, not just putting stamps in little holes and stamp books, so that's very wonderful as a hobby. In the philatelic world, where you compete internationally, you meet some unusual people. A few years ago, my Iceland was placed on exhibit in the first major U.S. Postal Service display case, in which multi-millions of dollars were spent by the Postal Service to attract attention to its work. They had the Royal Collection of Turning Taxis, who used to do the Postal Service for all of Europe. They had the Royal Collection of Monaco. They had my Iceland collection. From around the world came leading collections on display. And as I've said twice, the champion of champions. I kept the Columbian States back until I could write a series of articles that are now going to be published, which in essence will explain to the world this issue of the states like the American colonies before the United States became a country. There were Columbian states before Columbia became a nation. And these classics that represent the smallest stamps in the world have been sought after by all the famous collectors, Ferrari, Caspari, Larson, and on down the list, Lichtenstein, and great collectors of the world. And from boyhood on, I was able to be a vacuum cleaner before anybody understood the stamps or their value. And people were amazed to find that in a classic issue, where one issue there are only 9 covers known anywhere in the world, and all 9 of them are in this collection, and other such other such surprising monopoly. The other champion of champion candidates do have some other competitors in the world, though mine continues to win as the best. The Columbian States has no competition. We will write the book on philately and Columbian States, and the issues will begin to hit the collecting world, Collectors Club and London Philatelists and other such magazines in the months ahead. We brought it out to Dallas. To make the long story short, against an overwhelming collection of Confederate states and other similar high-quality collections, it gained the Grand Award. It's on display in the Marriott Hotel in Dallas. That's why I'm telling you this. You folks who listen in Dallas might be interested in going out to see it, as well as all the other marvelous collections of the Dallas Philatelic Show. It is on display at the Marriott Hotel in Dallas. I've forgotten the room. All I know is the room has the word quorum on it. So you go to the desk and say, you got a room here with the word quorum on it. That's where the stamps are on display. The entire exhibit will be on display. All the competitors of the Dallas show are on display there. All the ribbons of all various levels, the gold medals, the reserve grand, the research awards, and I'm very pleased to tell you, you can go see the Colombian States. We won the Grand Award. That relieved a lot of my stress.
You don't, And to many of you,
you will wonder, well, what's this got to do with anything? Not to the people that were part of Secret One. How many remember some of our objectives at Secret One? We achieve them. It takes time. That encourages us to believe Secret Six and Secret Seven will also be accomplished. I was amazingly better after Thursday night when I came and partook of communion. Better on Friday. Better Friday night. Saturday was my best day. This morning, which I write down as simple demonic attack because of the service that I was determined to conduct today, one of the worst days for pain. I ask your prayers, and I believe God will touch me as this service progresses. I still believe that God has a purpose in all of this, and that purpose is achieved. He's going to heal me because my work is far from finished. Life, Leviticus declares in the Old Testament, the life of the soul resides in the blood. And God said, for sin comes death. Thus, there's a lot of bloodletting and outpouring of blood in the Old Testament. Likewise, the new, when you consider the cross of Jesus. Modernists want to take that bloody side out of Scripture because most of them are even unaware of the verse that says the life of the soul resides in the blood. And all these graphic pictures of animals dying and birds dying in sacrifice are to teach the truth twofold. That God meant it when he said, for sin comes death. And as the blood poured forth, the life of the soul is pouring out, and death is the result. The other thing, the picture of God's mercy anticipating the death of his son, is that these sacrificial pictures always are portraying that God allows vicarious death, the death of a substitute in the place of the sinner, that he takes the blood of another, the outpoured life, the death of another in the place of the deserving sinner. Obviously, the question, how can the blood of animals and goats suffice for one, a man that is more valuable, is answered when one worth more than all of us dies in our stead. And we understand these were but types and pictures taken temporarily because the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world would pour out his blood, his life, that we all might live. We go again and again to the communion table to remember the Lord laid on him the iniquity of us all. And as I taught Thursday night, he literally wore our iniquity. And the Lord laid on him our sicknesses and our infirmities. And when you use a phrase like that grand song, the blood has never lost its power, it has no meaning unless you can understand it's pointing to Christ, the Son of Glory, whose life meant enough to God, our Heavenly Father, that he could stand in for all of us. And when his blood was spilled, it bought up all mankind and was sufficient to cover all sins. That blood, in God's view, has never lost its power to save and to heal.
Last Sunday, I spoke on Gideon in the 6th chapter of Judges with the help of a Spanish translator. Only really got started. Today I want to finish the message of Gideon. And I know I cannot do it with the time of two languages. So today you Latinos are going to practice your English. Judges 6, by way of review. The Midianites have oppressed Israel for 7 long years. The number is symbolic. It means more than just the 7 years. It has to do with completion, perfection. The testing and the temptation time was completed, having perfected its purpose, and God found Gideon threshing wheat in a wine press. Hollow depression in the ground, hidden by the vines in the vineyard. Hunkering down in fear, his highest hope to get enough bread for just one more day, and secreted sufficiently in the harvesting thereof that the Midianites wouldn't steal it from him as he came out of the vineyard. You don't harvest grain in the vineyard. He knew that. Thus he hoped to get away with harvesting enough bread for one day without being caught. You know the story. I preach on this message every year. But let me bring us together in the review, because I found last Sunday I needed it, and I think most of you did too. And the angel of the Lord appears to Gideon there. The King James has it that this angel said, "The Lord is with thee, thou mighty man of valor." Verse 12, "The Lord is with thee, thou mighty man of valor." And you know better, you've listened to me, that that's not what was said in the original. The ancient Syriac versions have it, "The Lord is with thee, the one," namely the Lord, "the one who is mighty in valor." Now there are some important words that I will review again for you today in the Hebrew. The Lord. Jehovah. That. And there's various ways it's pronounced. In fact, I think I'll do a doc note this week, just because I think you'll find it interesting. The Jews would not pronounce the word Jehovah or Yahweh. And this letter Vav sometimes also shows up in vocabularies as wa, but vav is the more accurate, from which you get the tetragrammaton or Jehovah, Y, Yod, Yeho, Va, And the vowels that are later additions and the little dots and dashes and marks that later on were added into the Hebrew language. Originally it had no vowels and a complicated system of dots and points and dashes determine your vowels passed down through oral tradition. This word, if they interpret this letter as wah, they'll say Yahweh. Or if it's Vav, Yah, or Yod, Ho, Va. And the reason we have Jehovah, and this is why I think I'll do a dot note on it, is that there was no Y in one of the languages as it matriculated through to the English, and they substituted a J. So we have Jehovah in our transliteration, though the letter is Yod, and should be Yahovah, or Yehovah. Now, I think I'll do a doc note this week on the confusion regarding this word and the translations in the Old Testament, because you have Lord in capital letters, you have God in capital letters, you have Lord God in capital letters, all of which is based upon later additions of the vowels and the points, whether or not it's dot or a dot dot and various other vowel signs, because they substituted the word Adonai, my Lord. They would not pronounce the word Jehovah. Why? I don't know, because God, when he revealed himself to Moses, said, by my name, Jehovah, will I be revealed unto thee. But Jewish theologians thought it too holy a name to pronounce, so they would substitute Adonai. Occasionally, Elohim would be substituted. And the way they would show it is they would, in later times, though the consonants would be Jehovah, they would use the vowel sounds that made no sense, except you knew their theological eccentricity. They would use the vowel sounds for Adonai or for Elohim. So you would see the consonants Yahweh, but the vowel signs as you read it would be incongruous with the consonants and would be your cue to pronounce it as you read it in the public synagogue, to read it as Elohim or Adonai, and thus the vowel sounds became a kind of secret code written in, though the consonants remained the same. I think I'll give you a dot note on that later this week, and to those listening to this message, dot note number 29. Is available, which has to do with the words I'm going to look at in this appearance of the angel to Gideon again today, and it's yours for the asking. The telephone number appears on the screen. When the message ends and the music plays, the announcer will give it many times, but the address to write is easy. We're number one, Los Angeles, P.O. Box 1, Los Angeles, California, Dr. Gene Scott, P.O. Box 1, Los Angeles, California, 90053. Yahweh is the word being used here. The Lord is with thee. Literally, if we go to the Syriac, the one who is mighty. Or the Mighty One. And that word is Gabor. Literally, G-B-R, which is the Mighty One. And in the dot note that's available to you, I give you the full meanings of Gabor. Powerful, warrior, tyrant champion, excelling giant, mighty one, strong one. You think Gideon was any of those? Huh? Pardon my English? Hell no. He was anything but Gabor. He was jellyfish, hiding in a vineyard, threshing wheat. What happened, literally, is the Lord, who is the Lord of hosts, Yahweh, the mighty one, Gabor, and mighty in Ta'il. K-Y-L. Ta'il. We know all about Ta'il by now, don't we? As distinct from Ozi, which is God's life or strength in us, that Psalm 84 speaks about, Ta'il is add-on strength that draws from the mighty one who is the Lord of hosts, ability to control everything and focus it where he wants it. Jeremiah once said, concerning God, speaking for God, and I've used this illustration many times, I will hasten my word to perform it. The picture is that of a magnifying glass that catches the rays of the sun and brings them to focus with intensity on one spot where all these diverse rays can be harnessed and through the glass brought in a concentrated focus until they can burn a hole through something. That's the Hebrew pictorial word when it says God will hasten his word to perform it. Everything that the Lord of hosts has available, which is everything, he brings it and focuses it on his word to make it come to pass. This angel of the Lord is there to announce to Gideon in his state, 7 years are up, God's going to pick a man now. Ephesians 1, God picked Gideon, if for no other reason to show forth his power. But in a sense, Gideon could wish he'd been caught by the Midianites. I want you to think of that paradoxical truth for a moment. Things were no longer the same. There were the simple elements, the terror of the Midianites, and the reality of his impoverishment and his problem. And it was him against them. He was losing, but getting on. He was surviving, not very well. At least he was going to have bread for one day. Oh, it's kind of bad if he goes back to the eighth year and remembers how it was before the Midianites arrived. But nothing's ever going to be the same again. Alas!
This is the end of Side 1. For more of the teaching, please turn the tape over for Side 2. Thank you.